From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, they might be giants. The band's clever lyrics and catchy melodies have won a cult following, but they've also reached a mass audience through their theme songs for The Daily Show and Malcolm in the Middle. We'll talk with John Linnell and John Flansburgh. They have a new extended play CD and are currently on tour. Also, before Dawn of the Dead, there was Night of the Living Dead. We hear from George Romero, the director of both. There's a new remake of his Dawn of the Dead. And a review of the final episode of The Apprentice and a look ahead at The Restaurant. Then film critic David Edelstein reviews Kill Bill Volume 2. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair indicated support today for a plan for a caretaker government in Iraq. President Bush said the proposal by UN envoy Lakhdar Brahimi shows promise.
We welcome the proposals presented by the UN special envoy Brahimi. He's identified a way forward to establishing an interim government that is broadly acceptable to the Iraqi people.
Prime Minister Blair said the allies want a plan that will transform a country that's been under tyranny.
Our task is to take this state and turn it into a democracy, stable and prosperous, a symbol of hope to its own people and throughout the whole of the Middle East.
Brahimi's proposal calls for dissolving the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council and replacing it with a caretaker government that would run the country until elections can be held early next year. The U.S. military is working to confirm the identity of a man on a videotape who says he's a U.S. soldier held hostage by Iraqi insurgents. NPR's Ann Hawk reports.
The videotape first aired on the Arab TV network Al Jazeera. It shows a soldier sitting on the floor with masked gunmen standing behind him. U.S. Central Command Captain Bruce Frame says the military is trying to determine the identity of the man who appears on the tape.
He does identify himself as PFC or Private First Class Keith Maupin, but we have not confirmed that yet.
20-year-old Private First Class Keith Maupin of Batavia, Ohio, has been missing since April 9th. He's one of two U.S. soldiers missing in Iraq after an attack on a fuel convoy near Baghdad. In a wave of kidnappings in Iraq in recent days, seven U.S. civilian contractors have also been taken captive. Ann Hawk, NPR News, Washington.
The African National Congress celebrated the most decisive election victory in its history today. NPR's Jason Beaubien reports from Johannesburg.
This was the African National Congress's largest victory ever. Even when Nelson Mandela was running in 1994, they only captured about 63% of the national votes. In this election, they've captured 70% of the votes. It's a huge election for them. They also managed to gain control of the two provinces that they haven't had control over in the past. So this gives them control both at the national level and at the provincial level. It solidifies the ANC as the dominant force in South African politics.
NPR's Jason Beaubien reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 54 points to close at 10,452 in heavy trading of more than 1.4 billion shares. Advances led declines by 3-1. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 6 points to close at 1,995, and the S&P 500 was up 6 to close at 1,134. This is NPR News. Kansas governor has vetoed a bill that would have required the state to issue permits to carry concealed weapons to eligible applicants. NPR's Greg Allen reports from Kansas City.
In vetoing the bill, Kansas's Democratic governor, Kathleen Sebelius, said she was concerned about the impact a concealed carry law would have on the state's law enforcement officers. She said they'd be forced to assume that any person stopped might have a firearm and that, quote, this would make their already dangerous job more difficult. It was the second time in recent years a concealed carry law has been vetoed in Kansas. Kansas is one of only four states nationwide, along with Illinois, Nebraska, and Wisconsin, that don't allow some form of concealed carry. Proponents of the bill said they would mobilize supporters to pressure lawmakers to vote to override the veto, but their prospects are uncertain. The bill passed both chambers of the legislature by a wide margin, but short of the two-thirds majority needed for an override. Greg Allen, NPR News, Kansas City.
The California State Legislature has approved a plan to reorganize the state's workers' compensation program. The measure aims to cut workers' compensation costs by billions of dollars by limiting medical benefits and by tightening standards of proof for workers who claim injuries. Workers would also be required to use only doctors who have been pre-approved by their employers and their insurance companies. Critics say California's current workers' compensation system is among the most expensive in the nation, while providing some of the lowest benefits for injured workers. The vote is seen as a victory for California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who argued that the high cost of workers' compensation insurance was driving businesses out of the state. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from The Atlantic Monthly, featuring deposed New York Times editor Howell Raines on the inside events that ended his tenure, on newsstands and at theatlantic.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Their sound is distinct, their lyrics are unusual, and their range of topics is nothing short of bizarre. The band They Might Be Giants is loved for their clever and sophisticated songs about unusual subjects. Like Dr. Worm, a song about a worm who dreams of being a rock and roll drummer. Or this song, Au Contraire.
Chops, he cried. This is what they said. Au contraire, Dave. Quite the opposite, in fact. As it happens, au contraire, mon frère. Franklin Delano Roosevelt knew not what to with my hat, he cried. Don't you think that's true?
Au Contraire from Indestructible Object, a new 5-song EP by They Might Be Giants. The collection is a preview of their upcoming full-length CD called The Spine, coming out later this year. The band is made up of John Flansburg and John Linnell, who have been making music together for about 20 years. Maybe it's surprising, and maybe it isn't, that They Might Be Giants has a lot of fans who are kids. Last year, the band released a new children's book and companion CD called Bed, 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 which was a follow-up to their recent children's CD, No. A profile in The New Yorker described They Might Be Giants as elders to a whole generation of smart, earnest nerd rockers. John Linnell plays keyboards and sings. John Flansburg plays guitar and sings. Terry spoke with Linnell and Flansburg last year. Here's the way they sound on one of their most recognizable songs, You're Not the Boss of Me, a defiant little jingle that sets the perfect frenetic tone for each week's episode of the Fox sitcom Malcolm in the Middle.
Yes, no, maybe. I don't know. Can you repeat the question? You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. You're not the boss of me now. And you're not so big. You're not the boss of me now.
I've always wondered about that song. How come it's You're Not the Boss of Me, and as opposed to the more grammatically correct, You Are Not My Boss?
Well, it was something that, you know, it was a very popular expression in the household that I grew up in. And I think, you know, grammar and syntax are not such a big deal with little kids.
Yeah, I think that's part of the appeal of the song in a way, is that the grammar is so screwy. It gives it a special childlike emphasis.
Do you have kids of your own now, either of you?
I do, yeah. I've got a boy in kindergarten.
And my wife and I are raising two cats.
Uh-huh.
They're in kindergarten as well.
John Linnell, now that you have a child, are you more interested in writing songs for children?
Well, there's a sort of a more practical urgency to it. I realize that a lot of the material that John and I have done in the past, while we've always sort of felt like we were a band that that kids could like. There are lyrics in our repertoire that I now see are pretty unsuitable for kids. So I like having the opportunity to do stuff that I can actually play for my son that doesn't scare him.
You've said that writing kids' songs has been artistically liberating, and I thought I'd play an example of a song I couldn't imagine you writing without the premise of, well, this is for kids, but it's a really terrific, it's a terrific song. It's called I Am Not Your Broom, and why don't we hear it, and then maybe you could talk about the writing of it. This okay. is I Am Not Your Broom from the They Might Be Giants album, No.
Now, broom, you must now sweep for me. The dust, it fills my room.
No, John, I will not sweep for you, for I am not your broom.
What nonsense are you speaking, broom? My words you must obey.
Another life awaits me, and I'm leaving you today. I am not your broom. I am not your broom. I've had enough. I'm throwing off my chains of servitude. I am not your broom. I am not your broom. No longer must I sweep for you, for I am not your broom.
That's I Am Not Your Broom from the CD No by They Might Be Giants, and my guests are John Linnell and John Flansburgh, the founders of They Might Be Giants. Can you talk a little bit about writing I Am Not Your Broom?
Sure, yeah. Well, that was actually written before we started putting together a record for kids.
That's not proving my point.
I think it's an example of something that there are a few songs on No that we sort of reworked to make them more appropriate for kids. And that one, I guess, we just figured would be okay, and, though it includes words like servitude, which I guess you have to explain to kids what that's about. Even the concept of the wage slave broom or whatever the relationship is a little bit hard for kids to understand.
I suppose.
Well, getting back to Bostonia, I think it's sort of actually a universal theme among little brothers everywhere.
Right.
Servitude is something every family understands.
I love the song though because it works just on a, you know, on a literal, almost like housework level, but it's also could be like the angry lover or the angry worker.
And yeah, well, it was kind of meant to be completely literal. The song was written after I got a hold of one of these little inexpensive cameras in the shape of an eyeball that you can plug into your computer, and I realized like John and I could actually make our own videos, not for $500,000, but for, you know, the $99 it cost to buy this thing. So I started out, you know, looking around the room for something to use in the video, and all there really was my broom and my face. And so that pretty much was the entire basis for this song.
Right.
In addition to writing songs for children, you're still writing whatever songs you want to write. And you just have this knack for coming up with lyrics that say things that songs don't often say, or at least they don't often say it in the way you say it in your songs. I guess I'm thinking here as an example of your song Older. I mean, there's a lot of songs that are kind of bittersweet about getting on in years and stuff, but I can't think of one that's as kind of blunt as Older.
Yeah, I think that you know, some of my favorite stuff that we've done just kind of emerges. You know, I mean, it's not that we're not thinking about what we're doing, but I think often stuff just kind of pops out and then you make sense of it after the fact. And Older was that kind of song. It kind of felt like it wrote itself because it had this sort of weird unconscious quality.
John Linnell, were you thinking about getting older when you wrote the song, or did a clever rhyme just come to you?
I pretty much think about getting older all the time.
Do you?
In fact, I mean, the funny thing about our stuff generally is I think that John and I have a lot of anxieties and concerns that are sort of floating in the background that are just there in the songs because that's what's in our heads. You know, the music is often much happier, and I think that's one of the reasons why people think we're appropriate for their kids, even our adult material. But yeah, I mean, that's death and things like that are pretty much constant topics for us.
Yes, with song titles like Hopeless Bleak Despair.
Hopeless Bleak Despair being an example, yeah.
But what I want to play is older. So why don't we give that a listen? And this is from the They Might Be Giants album called Mink Car.
You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're even older, and now you're even older. You're older than you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're older still. Time is marching on, and time is still marching on. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's sooner still.
Just for the edification of your listeners, that's a Rausch fife and a sarrusophone.
That's right.
Which you won't hear too often.
Are there any Rausch fife or sarrusophone enthusiasts out there?
They're real ancient. Well, one of them, I guess, it would be called.
One of them's a 19th century instrument that's still right. Hanging around. One of them really is like a, I guess, from the Renaissance.
Yeah.
The
sarrusophone is sort of an ancestor of the saxophone. And the engineer actually turned to us in the middle of the recording session and said, I know why this instrument didn't catch on. It doesn't work.
Maybe that's why there was something about the song that was reminding me of like an early chant.
Right, yeah, right.
Absolutely.
That's kind of what we're going for. I mean, it was definitely a conscious effort to, you know, create a sort of otherworldly, out of time,
something with spider webs on it.
Yeah,
right.
So get me some instrument that has some spider webs,
right.
Please.
John Flansburgh and John Linnell, who are the band They Might Be Giants, they have a new 5-song collection EP called Indestructible. It's a preview of their new CD, which comes out later this year. We'll hear more of their interview with Terry Gross after this break. This is Fresh Air.
I'll be in the back. And I don't need the help. I'm good here in the back. I'm good all by myself. I'm busy taking stock of all the things that I forgot and making mental notes of just exactly where I lost the plot. I stuck around too long, feeling sorry for myself.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with John Flansburgh and John Linnell, who make up the band They Might Be Giants.
You still have Dial-A-Song, which mm-hmm. is one of the early things that made the band unique. John, why don't you describe it?
Well, it's basically just a phone number in Brooklyn that's connected to a phone machine, it's like a 80s style phone machine that breaks all the time because it can't really hold up to the weight of the calls. But you simply hear a song. And the idea of it kind of came out of, you know, we came up as a band in the mid-80s in sort of a weird downtown New York, Lower East Side, East Village art and performance context. And it seemed like an interesting way to find a different kind of audience for what we were doing. We were playing in a lot of clubs at 1 a.m, and it seemed sort of unreasonable to think that a curiosity seeker would stay up that late. So this was a way to kind of reach out to them. And phone machines were really a fad at that moment. I mean, it's hard to think of phone machines as being new, but they were a brand new idea. So we were kind of harnessing, just the latest technology and using it to sort of show our songs, you know, get our songs to people without having any kind of, other support.
And how has the use and the meaning of the Dial-A-Song changed over the years?
I don't think it particularly has. I mean, it's still the exact same setup. There's only one line. It's the place where all of our material kind of gets its beginning. All the demos of songs that will eventually wind up in the show or on records or will be, you know, are doomed to obscurity, all make their way, you know, first through Dial-A-Song. And I think that the audience has not changed all that much. I mean, originally there was this real, originally I think it was a more local thing where there were sort of downtown New York people at work listening on their speakerphones. But I think there's still that element. There's people who call it up sort of as a way to break up their day, you know, just something to amuse them.
Yeah. Although I think the internet has kind of largely, you know, in some ways, the way people use the internet for entertainment at work reminds me, it's as if it's the biggest Dial-A-Song service of all time. You know, it's just a great way to get away from your job.
One of the things I was thinking about Dial-A-Song is that it must be really liberating, you know, as a songwriter, to have this venue where you could just like toss something off if you wanted to, put it on,
yeah,
there, and see how you like it. Live with it a while.
It's super exciting. Yeah. Although there is this aspect to the phone machine that's really deadly, which is that when you put the cassette in the machine, like, people start calling in, and if they don't like the song, they'll hang up in the middle. So you're immediately reminded of whatever, you know, you might be just really digging yourself and the song you just did, and then, you know, you pop it in, you think, they are gonna love this. And then you know, it's like click, you know.
How do you know that they've hung up in the middle?
Oh, because you can hear the machine rewinding before it finishes the song.
Yeah, we run the risk of, if we take that kind of thing too seriously, of trying to make more and more spectacular sounding music that maybe would get away from what we were trying to do in the first place, you know. So become more like, you know, Fox News or something.
Right.
All the explosions right at the top.
That would be good. They might be giants. Dial-A-Song. 26 hours a day, 9 days a week.
Right. Oh, my God.
Unfiltered
my
music.
My arms and legs are on fire.
Unfiltered music. You can handle it. Yeah, so there's all sorts of things you can do.
Look forward to that.
with recordings. You know, I mean, I don't know. We try not to pay too much attention to the front row and too much attention to people hanging up in the middle. I think, you know, we recognize what we do is kind of fragile in a way, so.
Well, I thought this might be a good time to play what was, I think, like your first, you know, hit. This is Don't Let Start.
Mm-hmm.
John, can you talk about writing the song?
Well, this is one of those songs that is kind of in the clothing of a pop song. It's got this sort of rockin' arrangement. But the problem I've often had is I write songs starting with the music and the melody, and then I have this job of trying to fill in the words to a melody that's already written. So I end up having to sort of cram words in because the syllables fit. And that, I think, accounts for a lot of the lyrics in this one, which seem, they're not exactly on point all the time. It's a song that has a, you know, sort of a strangely meandering lyric, and actually it was for that reason, you know, when we put our first record out, I just felt like the lyrics were so oddball that we originally talked about putting it first on the record, and at the last minute I swapped it out for another one because I thought Don't Let Start was just too confusing. But you know, people still wound up liking it, I think, because the music was sort of, you know, appealing.
Well, why don't we hear Don't Let Start? Anything else you want to say about it?
No.
Okay. So this is from the first They Might Be Giants recording.
Don't let start. This is the worst part. To believe for all the world that you're my precious little girl. But don't let start. I've got a weak heart and I don't get around how you get around. When you are alone, you are the cat. And do I need a apostrophe D? Need this touch? Don't let start. This is the worst part. Could believe for all the world that you're my precious little girl. But don't let start. I've got a weak heart and I don't get around. How you get around?
That's Don't Let Start from the first They Might Be Giants recording, and my guests are the founders of the band, John Linnell and John Flansburg.
I love being founders. It's a great feeling.
If like populations have become members of the band in subsequent years?
It sort of suggests, that
we're an institution.
That will carry on when we're gone as well, you know, that there will be statues of us.
And They Might Be Giants Hall.
Right.
Something to all look forward to.
No, it's a good way to describe it.
Since you didn't really set out to be performers, at least that's how it sounds hearing you talk, and it sounds like your goal in life wasn't to like be on stage. What was it like for you when you were on stage early on, and you had to find a way to be?
It was really mind blowing. It was just a very different sort of responsibility and a different kind of response than we were anticipating. I mean, I remember our very first gig very vividly. We actually we had, you know, put the show together. We were working with a drum machine, so everything had to be kind of very tightly rehearsed with this. And our sort of gimmick as a band was that we had these very tricky arrangements that were very fast-paced, and the tape didn't stop, so it just was like this one long performance of very short songs. And so it was a real memory test.
There was a reason for that, too.
We
had this idea that if we stopped the tape or had blank spots in the tape, that people would realize that no one was clapping.
Right.
So we decided to do a show that had no breaks whatsoever.
It was a real defense mechanism. And we went up there and did the show, and immediately, you know, people started kind of like laughing in a very happy...
That's right.
You know, I mean, they weren't like laughing at us. They were sort of... I think they felt like they were laughing with us, but it was a very... it was just very unexpected for us. We really didn't think it was going to be that way.
Well, John Flansburg, John Linnell, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
John Flansburg and John Linnell, who are the band They Might Be Giants. They have a new 5-song collection called Indestructible Object. It's a preview of their new CD, which comes out later this year. They have a concert tonight in Anaheim and concerts this weekend in L.A. and Santa Barbara. They'll also be playing later this year in Baltimore, Ann Arbor, Columbus, and Brooklyn. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Ant, a song from the new collection by They Might Be Giants.
There's an ant crawling up your back in the nighttime. There's an ant crawling up your back in the nighttime. But you think that's okay while you're sleeping. That ant crawled in your head in the nighttime. That ant crawled in your head in the nighttime. But you think that's okay while you're
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics, enduring works of literature in newly annotated editions, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. By TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. And by Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the new novel Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood, author of The Blind Assassin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the zombies walk the earth again. There's a new remake of Dawn of the Dead. We hear from George Romero, the director of the original and of its predecessor, Night of the Living Dead. Also, David Edelstein reviews Kill Bill Volume 2, and we consider the finale of The Apprentice and the return of the restaurant. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm David B. Cooley. Donald Trump's reality TV series The Apprentice ended its 12-week run on NBC last night. The final competition was between Harvard MBA Kwame and Chicago entrepreneur Bill. They were vying for a one-year job running one of Trump's companies at a salary of $250,000. And it came down to the wire. Even Trump's trusted lieutenants, George and Carolyn, saw different things in the two finalists.
This is not easy. What do you think, George?
Well, as you say, it's a very tough decision. My vote would go with Kwame. I think he handles himself well under pressure. I think he can adapt to some very serious circumstances. I wouldn't hold his track record in the past as much against him at this point as I've seen him now in really the line of fire. I can honestly see him as a better fit in the Trump organization in the long run. That's my feeling at that point.
He's outstanding. I agree with you. He's an outstanding guy.
He's outstanding.
Carolyn?
Well, George, I agree with you on Kwame. However, I disagree with the choice. I would go for Bill.
You agree with him in what way? He's outstanding?
I think Kwame is outstanding, but I do believe he is textbook, where I think Bill is practical. I actually see him as a better fit in this organization.
In the last half hour of the season finale, Trump called the two men back into the boardroom. But this wasn't the fake boardroom set that was constructed in Trump Tower. This was another fake boardroom set, constructed for the occasion in a New York TV studio. And as Trump made and announced his final decision, the walls were rolled back to reveal a previously hidden and quiet studio audience, which went nuts.
Kwame, I think you have an amazing future. You're a brilliant guy, great education, and I have no doubt that you're going to be a big success. But for right now, Bill, you're hired.
That energy made for terrific live television and a very entertaining finale. It's also familiar because producer Mark Burnett, who concocted the series, pulls a similar trick each year on another of his hugely popular reality shows, Survivor. That show, like The Apprentice, starts out with 16 contestants, divides them into teams, makes them perform a number of challenges, and each week makes some people vulnerable for rejection and the rest immune. In the last phase, it becomes every man for himself and every woman for herself in a high-stakes battle to be the last person standing. In The Apprentice, as in Survivor, how you behave under fire and with your peers may come back to haunt you because the semifinalists get to weigh in with their opinions. Even the live finale and the replication of the familiar set is ripped straight from the Survivor playbook. And why not? Burnett's Survivor, now in the last month of its All-Star edition, continues to be entertaining, surprising, and totally worth watching. And on Monday, the second season begins of another Burnett series, NBC's The Restaurant, and it's a significant improvement on the first season. Last summer, The Restaurant was all about the effort by popular young chef Rocco DiSpirito to design and open a restaurant in 5 weeks, as reality TV cameras recorded everything. It was a decent but contrived show and didn't really connect with viewers or critics the way Survivor and The Apprentice did. This new season, though, is about a battle of wills and control between celebrity chef Rocco and the restaurant's financial backer, Jeffrey Chodorow. He owns 22 restaurants, and Rocco's is the only one that loses money. Chodorow wants change, but the two men haven't even spoken in months. Almost instantly, the battle lines are drawn as consultants invade the restaurant, staffers don't know where to place their loyalty, and the tension gets and stays unbelievably high. Oh, and in the continued sense of Burnett borrowing from his other shows, it takes less than 2 hours of The Restaurant for someone to utter Trump's famous catchphrase, "You're fired." Survivor and The Apprentice last night, The Restaurant next Monday, that's three primetime network series coming from the same TV producer within 1 week, and all of them are good, really good. That consistency and prolific output is a rarity on television. Joss Whedon did it 1 year when Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Angel, and Firefly all were on the air. And David E. Kelly managed it years ago when he was juggling Ally McBeal, The Practice, and Chicago Hope. Burnett is the first reality TV producer to pull off a similar hat trick. And given the poor quality of most of his competition, it's a good bet he'll be the last. In a TV genre devoted to recognizing and getting the best from your talent, and to beating the competition, Burnett has proven to be a master at his own game. Mark Burnett's The Apprentice ended its first season last night, Burnett and Donald Trump will be back with a second season. Meanwhile, Burnett's The Restaurant begins its second season Monday on NBC, and his Survivor All-Stars continues Thursdays on CBS. That's Oscar Peterson, recorded in 1959. We'll be back with Terry's interview with film director George Romero, responsible for the cult hit Night of the Living Dead and its even more ghoulish sequels. This is Fresh Air. When the movie remake of Dawn of the Dead hit theaters the weekend of March 19th, it generated a brief but measurable zombie jamboree. It was number one at the box office, earning $27.3 million and temporarily nudging Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ from the top slot. The new Dawn was based on the screenplay of the 1978 original, written by George Romero as a sequel to his 1968 cult horror film Night of the Living Dead. In that film, as in its sequel and its recent remake, corpses rise from the dead to feast on the flesh of the living.
This is the latest disclosure in a report from National Civil Defense Headquarters in Washington. It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder. A widespread investigation of reports from funeral homes, morgues, and hospitals has concluded that the unburied dead are coming back to life and seeking human victims. It's hard for us here to believe what we're reporting to you, but it does seem to be a fact.
George Romero made Night of the Living Dead on a shoestring budget working on the weekends. It became a cult classic and is now in the archives of the Museum of Modern Art. Night of the Living Dead had scenes that were graphic for the time, shots of zombies munching on arms and internal organs. But in terms of state-of-the-art gore, it was nothing compared to the two sequels Romero directed, the original Dawn of the Dead and 1985's Day of the Dead. Terry spoke with Romero in 1988.
Now, I presume you loved horror films when you were growing up. Did you like them because they scared you, or were there other things in terms of the mood of the movies that you liked a lot?
I liked them principally because they scared me. They were the most fun for me. That I think because the things that scare me in real life are always the more realistic things, the fear that someone might drop a bomb on my head, or that someone, when I was growing up, I actually went through, in New York City, blackouts when we had to close the windows and worry about air raids. And I don't know whether those were realistic worries or not, but as a kid, when we all had to run around clothes, pulling down the drapes and turning the lights off, it was a very frightening experience. And then to think that... I remember when John Cameron Swayze over the television told me personally that the Russians now had the atomic bomb, then I knew that we were goners, you know.
Is that why there's always some newscaster telling about the latest progress of the zombies in your movies?
Probably, yeah. I have a real strong concern for what electronic media has done to us and bringing us the news as quickly as it does, and not letting us sort of discover things for ourselves or allow them to gestate, It's just a little too, I think it's the pace more than, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be brought the news, but it's just the pace at which things are fired at us, I think, is maybe a little too fast sometimes.
Can I read something that Variety wrote when Night of the Living Dead came out in 1968? I said, this film casts serious aspersions on the integrity of its makers, distributor Walter Reed, the film industry as a whole, and exhibitors who book the picture, as well as raising doubts about the future of the regional cinema movement and the moral health of filmgoers who cheerfully opt for unrelieved sadism. Until the Supreme Court establishes clear-cut guidelines for pornography of violence, Night of the Living Dead will serve nicely as an outer limit definition by example. Mm-hmm. Well, did you feel when you made that movie that you were compromising your moral health or that of your audience?
I didn't feel that way at all. And Night of the Living Dead did, I think, I attribute much of its success to the fact that it was one of the films that people wrote about in those terms. The piece that you just read was one of 100 pieces that were pleading for some sort of, that was in the period of time between the Hays Commission and the MPAA, which we have now, and there was no governing panel at all that was indicating, there was no censor board, there was no one indicating what, in any fashion, what was to be expected from the content of a film. And, you know, I certainly didn't make Night of the Living Dead for it to be showed at a kiddie matinee. And that was principally what it was criticized for, and I believe that rightfully so, that it shouldn't have been shown at kiddie matinees. That's not who the film was made for.
It's a very extreme film. I mean, I don't think ever before in a movie were zombies shown as explicitly munching on people's limbs. Did you think that the extremity of it would also help get you attention?
You know, the fact is it wasn't nearly as extreme as some of the films that had come out and been made before it. I mean, there were a whole string of films that were, you know, these ghoulie films, or real splatter films that came out actually before Night of the Living Dead. They got narrower distribution and they didn't get as much attention,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't get the same sort of mainstream release.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I spit on your grave, I eat your flesh, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. There was a whole wave of films that came out that were really much smaller and much more, even though Night of the Living Dead is called a cult film, it's really been seen by too many people to call it a cult film. It really was not. It came out in a very wide release initially.
Did you like all those other films that you just mentioned?
Those kinds of things, as I said, what scares me is the bomb, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so I have never yet been really shocked in my heart and soul. I've never, you know, sat there with my mouth open at any effect that I've ever seen in a movie. And we consciously, all we said to ourselves when we made Night of the Living Dead is, well, let's overstep the bounds of convention and let's not cut away when the monster is about to munch on someone's arm. And so we just didn't. And there's a rather short sequence in the film that shows that. And there's one sequence that everyone points at particularly when after the two young people are blown up and burned in the car. And that's the sequence that everyone talks about. It lasts for maybe 20 seconds, and there are probably a half a dozen very explicit shots in it. It's not even Grand Guignol to the extent that the sequels that I did were intentionally sort of Grand Guignol. Those sequences were done for the sake of seeing how well we could do them, and how shocking we could be. In the case of Night of the Living Dead, it really was not quite that. I didn't think it was quite that gruesome.
Well, Tom Savini, who's done a lot of the special effects for your movie, said in his book that he wasn't happy with how the 3M stage blood photographed in Dawn of the Dead, which is the second in your zombie trilogy. And I wonder if you felt that way, too.
No, I liked it. And Tom and I will always argue about it. I liked the fact that it looked comic book. Tom felt it looked too bright and red. It didn't look mm-hmm. real. And I feel that helps ease the pain a little bit, the fact that it was more comic book. I like the fact that it looked very comic book.
I'd love to see some of the outtakes from your zombie movies. I figure that there's probably wounds falling off accidentally and blood spurting in the wrong direction.
Oh, yeah. Always have. We have a lot of outtakes. I wish that I could, I wish that you could, I wish I could have afforded to keep it together and even make a little film from some of them. It would have been great. But.
How did you come up with the way you wanted the zombies in your zombie movies to walk? Did you demonstrate for them how you wanted them to look?
No, it's funny. At the moment when you have 40 people in makeup looking at you and you're trying to direct them and tell them what you want them to do, if you make the slightest little arm movement, then in the next shot everyone makes that arm movement. And so if I pretty much leave it up to them and just ask them to do whatever they think a zombie might do if it had just recently come back and had stiff limbs and come back from the dead with stiff limbs. Because if you demonstrate at all, then all of a sudden you get everyone doing exactly that. And the only way that I've found to keep everyone doing their own thing is to let them do whatever they want to do.
I know that a lot of students were in Night of the Living Dead. Have people kept up with you over the years trying to be extras, trying to be zombies in your movies?
Oh, yeah. It's so funny. It's like someone wrote once that there's some kind of a cultist kind of chic to being a zombie in one of these movies. I don't know. I'm always amazed at people that call and say they want to come in and they want to be a zombie or they want to do a special kind of a shtick or a special kind of business. We haven't been able to accommodate as many people as have requested to come in. So it's never a problem getting zombies.
Now, I read that when you were 14, you were making a little movie on your own. And you were, I think, arrested for for throwing a burning dummy off a roof for
yeah.
your film. What's the story behind that?
I grew up in New York City, and I lived in the Bronx in a place called Parkchester, and I was shooting with my uncle's 8mm camera, and I was making a movie called The Man from the Meteor, and The Man from the Meteor was ultimately shot with his own ray gun and fell flaming off the roof of the building where I lived in Parkchester. And I set fire to a little dummy and dropped it off the roof without having failed to contact the police and let them know I was going to do this. And so, yeah, I was hauled away by the police and my parents were called and it wasn't a serious arrest. I didn't have to spend the night in jail or anything, but I was actually taken in.
Did your parents try to put a halt to your filmmaking or did they support you?
Well, you know, when I was making The Man from the Meteor, they just thought that I was off doing, something that was a hobby. And I thought it was a hobby. I thought movies were made by, by some sort of royalty that was born into the right and privilege to make them. Or they were made by elves off in Hollywood. And when I was growing up, it really was the only place that movies were being made was in Hollywood. And when I went to Pittsburgh to go to school at Carnegie Mellon, I went to study painting and design. And at the school, which had a very, and still does, have a very active and excellent theater department, the dean at the time convinced me to transfer into the theater department, and that was the first time that I ever had any inkling that, gee, maybe there's some kind of a career, or these are real people that do this kind of thing. It's not anything magic. But even at that time, there was no hardware. Nobody was making films at a university. All we were, a film class at a university in those days was comprised of watching the Battleship Potemkin and talking about it afterwards. There was no hardware. But some friends of mine and myself, when we got out of school, set up a little company to do commercials on film in Pittsburgh, which was, I guess, somewhat audacious. But at the time, even commercials were not being done in small cities like Pittsburgh.
You've said that you've never really been afraid of the kind of images you create. What scares you is real stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, have you ever been haunted by any image that you've created for a movie?
Only to the extent that I've been typecast as someone that makes this kind of movie. And so that's a kind of haunting, I guess. But again, that's reality. That's not anything, that's not part of the fantasy. No, I haven't been.
Anything you'd be too squeamish to film?
I couldn't shoot news, I don't think. I mean, again, it comes back to that. I don't think I would want to cover Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I could do it. In the context of fiction, I'm not bothered by it because I guess I feel that it's safe, and I'm always actually a little bit alarmed by the way people react to it. I'm more alarmed by people reacting violently to the violence in my films than I am by the violence in films.
George Romero speaking with Terry Gross in 1988. His movie Dawn of the Dead was just remade for the new millennium. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews Quentin Tarantino's Kill Bill Volume 2. This is Fresh Air. When film director Quentin Tarantino began assembling an early cut of his action film Kill Bill, it clocked in at more than 3 hours. So Tarantino chopped it into two volumes. The first came out last year as Kill Bill Volume 1. Now, just as that film is released on DVD, movie theaters make room for Volume 2, in which Uma Thurman's blood-soaked bride comes back to finish off her remaining would-be assassins. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Kill Bill Volume 1 became a litmus test on the subject of violence in movies. The saga of the bride, played by Uma Thurman, who set out to avenge the murder of her wedding party and unborn child by a man named Bill and his assassination squad. The film was easy to denounce because the gore was both over the top and 100% gratuitous. It wasn't yoked to a death wish message about liberal judges and courts that can't protect us, and it didn't have the righteous uplift of something like Gladiator. I called it An American in Paris with Arterial Spray, and the only emotion I perceived was Quentin Tarantino's glee in trying to distill the hundreds of grindhouse pictures and chop-socky videos on which he'd been weaned into one fat, masturbatory epic in which a sexy chick fights other sexy chicks with a humongous Japanese samurai sword. What's not to love? Kill Bill Volume 2, the second half of Tarantino's Revenger epic, is far less absurdist than its predecessor. The blood flow is stanched, the body count low, and the quotient of chatter is way, way up. It's a climactic decrescendo. I'm not saying it's subtle. The wit is broadsword rather than rapier. The motives are elemental, and there's still a load of gross-out violence. The difference is that Tarantino finds ways other than carnage to give pleasure. There's a magnificent perversity in the tender first scene, a flashback between the bride and Bill, whose face was never seen in part one. Played by David Carradine, Bill has shown up out of the blue at the wedding rehearsal of the woman he calls Kiddo. We now know because her name is Beatrix Kiddo. Beatrix was Bill's number one assassin until she fled, pregnant, with his baby, in search of a quieter life. Now, in an El Paso church, she hears a familiar panpipe and moves through the doorway in a shot straight out of The Searchers.
Hello, kiddo.
How did you find me?
I'm the man.
What are you doing here?
What am I doing? Well, a moment ago I was playing my flute. This moment, I'm looking at the most beautiful bride these old eyes have ever seen.
Why are you here?
Last look.
Are you gonna be nice?
I've never been nice my whole life. But I'll do my best to be sweet.
I love Thurman's giddiness. She's just mad about Bill before he shoots her down, and even after. Tarantino famously courted Warren Beatty for Bill, which would have been heaven because of the childlike narcissism in Beatty's charm that you know could spill over into monstrousness. But Carradine is wonderful, too. Intense, but preternaturally cool. His weathered face held aloft by that triumphant Carradine family bone structure. His scenes with Thurman are both scary and, yes, sweet. The movie is a cartoon, though, the banter second-tier Tarantino, a cut above his imitators, but below the standard set by Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown. He's only in peak form at playing with your expectations, setting you up for one thing and blindsiding you with something else. I loved Michael Madsen's ex-assassin, a drunk who seems to have grown fatalistic and lost his taste for killing. And Beatrix's 4-year-old daughter is neither angel nor devil, but something tantalizingly in between. Tarantino serves up a parody of 70s Hong Kong martial arts training flicks that had me howling at its tacky zoom-ins and zoom-outs, and at Gordon Liu's huffy, sadistic master with his flyaway eyebrows and a long white beard that he whips over his shoulder like a scarf. Kill Bill Volume 2 is in a different league than The Punisher also opening this week, a sickeningly manipulative, by-the-numbers revenge movie in which the presumed dead hero comes back to get the people who wiped out his wife and little son. It's a bloodbath with one thing on its mind, making you go, yeah, punish him, make him die slowly. But neither of these movies, needless to say, is a patch on our greatest revenge drama, Hamlet, the story of a first-rate intellectual who finds himself trapped in a third-rate revenge play and can't quite get in sync with it. And neither has the moral horror of Steven Soderbergh's The Limey, in which a father's quest for revenge on the man who killed his daughter leads straight back to him. Kill Bill Volumes 1 and 2 are great fun, but when they're over, there's nothing to give us pause about our addiction to fantasies of retribution. The whole is a little less than the sum of its volumes.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Atlantic Monthly, featuring deposed New York Times editor Howell Raines on the inside events that ended his tenure, on newsstands and at theatlantic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Daryl Strawberry is known as much for his baseball brilliance as he is for his personal demons. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Sokolov. He has a new book about Strawberry's ultra-talented high school team then and now. Also, jockey Shane Sellers. He appears in a new HBO documentary about the difficult working conditions of jockeys. Join us for the next Fresh Air.